Okay, so last time we were talking about mostly page replacement, and we needed some idea of, well, if we're predicting what pages we want to actually replace, what things won't be accessed soon, hopefully, so we can use that space for something else. We need to have some model of how our data is in memory is actually going to be used. And we had two ideas. We had our working set idea, which is basically there's data the program needs. Needs and everything else we don't need. And the data the program needs is called its working set. That might change over time. We talked about having phases. So the program is using one thing during one part of it. And then it's running another set of functions, and it uses some other set of data. But during any time, we just want to keep the part of memory, the functions, and the variables, and the arrays, and so on, that it has active around. Yeah, this other model just had this zip distribution where we had this long tail, and this was more typical of very multi-user workloads, like a web server, where we have some things which are very popular, and we have lots of things which are less popular, and we can keep finding more and more and more less popular things. And in this case, we want to keep as many of the popular things as we can, and you know, the most, very most popular things are so much more popular than everything else, this is a big benefit to keeping them around, but we still have some return the further we go. It's not like the working set where you assume that once we're out of the working set, basically it doesn't matter. And based on both of these, we looked at things like LRU page replacement. So least recently used, our idea was that for both of these models, if we look at what things we've accessed recently, that's a good approximation of what they say we're going to keep accessing. Maybe not the most perfect approximation you can make based on knowing that your programs really have just a working set you could identify, or you really have the ZIF distribution, but a pretty good one. Now, unfortunately, while we can implement LRU exactly, like if we can run code on every page access, this is not practical for virtual memory. We don't want the OS running every time you touch memory. So we approximate LRU by either sampling these accessed or reference bits that would be set by the OS or the processor. So we have something in our page table entry saying, this page table entry has been used, we can clear it and access it, or we can just mark the page table entry invalid and wait for a page fault to happen and say, oh, it's actually being used, that's fine. And last time I talked about Linux's page replacement algorithm, which approximated LRU in this fashion, where they had an active list and an inactive list. I said that Linux detected references to the inactive list by marking it as invalid. That's not correct, it just scans the access bits. But either strategy would work, and on some platforms, you don't have this hardware support, so you just mark it invalid, that's all you actually need. But with either case, the idea is we get this periodic notion of, was this page actually used? And we can use that to say, well, at least it was accessed more recently than all these other pages, and we can use that to make a good decision that's kind of like least recently used, even if it's not a perfect approximation. But we don't need a perfect approximation anyways, because, well, we know that LRU isn't the best policy in the real world because we have some exceptions. And then we started talking about some of the more notable exceptions where LRU does a really bad job. So one of them is when you're periodically scanning over data, especially if that data is bigger than your memory. In this case, LRU is just doing bad things for you. You're keeping around this stuff where you're scanning over this large set of things. You're keeping around the recent part of it and not the older parts of it that you're going to access first. So we're doing the worst possible approximation of Belady's min, which we said minimized the number of replacements. And when things are bigger than memory, these extra accesses that we're keeping around that we're not going to touch again are just going to what people often call pollute the cache by taking up space that we really want to use for things that we're actually accessing repeatedly relatively quickly, like our code or our stack. Like it could potentially make it so our stack becomes less recently used and therefore is more likely to get evicted when we're accessing all these large files but only once. So we'll talk about a way of dealing with these non-LRU friendly patterns, which either don't fit into these working set or ZIF models, or they do, but the working set is just bigger than memory if you look at it that way. Okay, so first, some logistics stuff. So from anonymous feedback, I have these parenthetical remarks talking about implementing copy and writing the paging assignment. Do they mean the same thing? Yes. Pointing to the original physical page, the physical page. So the context here is in the paging assignment, we say, okay, you're making a child process. You need to set up its page table. And when you're doing copy and write, what we're going to do is the child's page table is going to point to all the same places after the fork. Later on, we'll fix that because the child should have separate memory. But I had these two cases where the page table entry points to the same place, but we do different things as far as how we manage reference counts and read-only bits. And that's why they're two separate cases, and I added these parenthetical remarks later, so they're perhaps less clear than they could be by being in one place to indicate that, yes, it's really the same thing the page table entry is pointing to, it's just reference bits and read-only bits that are a bit different. And on another, more anonymous feedback, probably from the same person based on timing, but I can't tell. Can I stop changing the assignment description? Yes, but I mean, I can try to do better at making it more obvious, though I think I'm doing reasonably kind, and I think you'd prefer it be edited rather than not. And I think you'd prefer having the hint section because technically I could just not provide it, but that would be really mean. And also make most people just not do the assignment. And yes, I'm sure my instructions are bad. I would appreciate feedback because I intend to use some of these assignments again, and I can at least improve it for that time. Also on the FAT assignment, which some of you may know exists, so, yes, we have a similar assignment to Grimshaw's section, and Grimshaw isn't doing the paging protection assignment. Our FAT assignment is due a week later, so I'm not giving you less time, I hope. I'm not trying to. It's due a week later. There's a checkpoint that's due earlier, but the checkpoint is, like, literally the minimum set of the assignment I can think of you submitting that I can actually test. Yeah. So the question is, are you still doing FAT right? No. And hopefully by the time I release this on Friday, we'll have some like testing code of some sort to release with it, which I don't know why, which Grimshaw's section will probably get that code too, because the TA should just, I'm trying to get the TA to release the code they actually used to test the assignment so you can use it to test it. Which would seems like a reasonable thing to provide that shouldn't be much effort. Okay, so that's on logistics. So any questions on the paging assignment before I move on today and talk about other paging issues? Yes?
For the paging assignment, do we edit fork at all, or are we just editing the copy?
The question is, for the paging assignment, do you edit fork? You should be able to do all your changes to copy UVM because copy UVM is called by fork and only fork. But you could also edit fork if you feel that works better. Yes?
Are we editing grow proc?
The question is, are you editing grow proc? Probably. You could edit alloc UVM instead, but alloc UVM is called in some other places where you probably don't want to change the behavior. Yeah.
Is there an obvious place for kernel data structures to reference count, or can you put it anywhere?
The question is, what file should I put my reference count data structure in? In my reference solution, I just put it as a global variable in vm.c, but you can pretty much put it anywhere. Okay, so last time when we finished up, we were talking about cases where LRU performs poorly. And I mentioned that these were cases where we're like scanning files once, repeated scans of large amounts of data. And the big problem with this is that these are common access patterns for like files on disk. So for example, if you think of like a word processor, when a word processor loads a file, it copies it into memory, it doesn't keep reading the file over and over again, typically. Typically, it loads it into memory, into different data structures in memory to edit it. When it's done, it writes the whole thing out from its data structures in memory. File's read once. It's not really actually worth it to cache it. And if you think of something like a movie, you play through the movie once, assuming you aren't seeking around a bunch. It's read once, it's not worth to keep your gigabyte movie file in memory, typically, because typically you aren't going to like look all around the file, we don't want to keep it around. And the problem with keeping them around spuriously is that empirically people have found out that for many real workloads, this ends up, as I said, polluting the cache, that you end up having things that you wanted to get cached, like your stack, heap, things like that, not being cached as much because scans of large files that are happening ends up saying, oh, there's a bunch of recently used stuff I should keep around, and that takes precedence over the things we actually wanted cached. And noticing this problem, Linux has a pattern where it tries to handle this. And the heuristic they use, again, the guess that is that they don't consider pages from files active until the second access. So the pages of files active until the second access. So this handles single scans through files, but still deals with a case where we actually are reading a file repeatedly or something like that. So the way that works is that unlike for anonymous pages, they still have their active and inactive list, and they're scanning this inactive list like for normal like heap pages over and over again to see if things are referenced. And when things are referenced once, if it's a file page, you know, they're gonna ignore it until the next time they scan over the list. So they're gonna say, we're gonna ignore the first time for a file page, and we're also going to guess for a file page that it's probably not worth keeping around. So we're gonna guess you're gonna do one scan. And if we see only one scan, we're going to say, for a file page, that's fine, we're done. We're done, nothing to do here. If we see you use it twice, then we're actually going to use the same logic, you know, referenced once, twice. So this is a file page, referenced twice, and this is a non-file, I should write, file refed once. So for a non-file, if it's referenced once, we make it active. For a file, if it's referenced twice, only then do we make it active. And that's the change, besides that we also start them as inactive, whereas for not things like the heap, we start it as active because we assume if we allocate the heap, you're using it for a while. We assume if you allocate access a file, you're using it once. So this is the slight change Linux uses in order to deal with these scans of files. So any questions on this policy? Yeah?
So it's just the same policy except it just adds like an extra condition for files?
So it's the same policy except we start in inactive instead of active, because new normal pages start in the active list. New non-file starts there. And yeah, we have this special case where we ignore the first reference if it's on the inactive list.
File pages on the inactive list?
What?
Or only file pages start off on the inactive
Yeah, so like heap pages, we want to start in the active list because our assumption is that if you're allocating like malloc in memory, you're using it. Our assumption with reading a file is that if you're reading a file, you're just reading it once and then you're not and then you're copying the data elsewhere, you're not gonna actually read the file again. And these are both heuristics, so they can be wrong. We can write programs, you know, where we always read files over and over again, and we always write to our heap once and never touch it again. Where this does the exact wrong thing. The reason it works out pretty well is because programs don't actually work this way. So, okay, so that's page replacement, and that's what Linux actually does, which I'm giving you as an example of like what real OSs have evolved to do. There's actually a bit of variety. There's like not consensus on what you should do when you're designing page replacement in your OS, but usually there's similar considerations to what you see in Linux, that you want to cache both file and non-file pages, that you want to deal with these common access patterns that you see, things like the working set model and the exceptions like scanning over files once. But there are different choices for dealing with that, but they're all based on this idea that we keep scanning pages for references to do something which kind of looks like approximating LRU, maybe with some exceptions. But everything we've talked about so far is about how we deal with page replacement, how we handle the case where we've accessed some pages and we need to bring in new pages. Which one of the pages we've accessed or not accessed do we get rid of? And here are the ideas. We're going to make the least bad choice as far as what we get rid of. But we're still going to pay this cost that when you access something, we're going to have to load it then. Or we're going to have to allocate space when you touch your heap to, or your stack, then. And we can be more proactive than that. So rather than loading or allocating memory on demand, we can do better than that. We can not wait for the page fault. We cannot wait for you to call read. We can say, oh, you're accessing this file. We can do better. We can see what you're doing. So for example here, let's say I read page 4 of a file, page 5, page 6. What's going to happen next? Any guesses? What? We're going to read page 7. And the operating system can say, oh, you just touched page 4, page 5, page 6, or you called read to read from page 4, page 5, page 6. You're probably going to read or touch page 7 next. This is an easy guess to make, and it's actually a valuable thing to do for an operating system, and this concept is called read ahead. That we're going to look at what you're doing, and we're going to read ahead of where you are. And we're gonna bring in these pages before you even try to access them. And so here we're doing even better than Blady's min can do because we actually are predicting the future and we're not waiting until we have to replace a page. So assuming we can guess right, this is, you know, basically the best we can possibly do. If we guess wrong, we have a bit of a cost. So what might happen if I guess wrong about this? How could that hurt my performance? So let's say I guess you're reading in page 7. Let's say I'm wrong. So how could that hurt the performance of my system? Yeah?
You can kick the page from the invalid list?
Yeah, so we're gonna kick out an inactive page, and in the worst case, not only have I decided to bring in this page 7 that, you know, I guessed wrong, we're not actually reading, but I've kicked out a page from the inactive list, which should have been active. Like, I was going to access soon instead. So the worst case, this policy does badly. But the hope is that we're only making guesses in cases like this, where we're pretty unlikely to be wrong. You know, if you see this, you'd be really surprised if instead of accessing page 7, I decided to access something I haven't touched for a minute. So, given that read ahead idea, tell me what, let's come up with an algorithm for doing redefine. So I've given you sort of the obvious case. How would you like write code to track this? So what information should we keep around in order to make these guesses? What should we look for? And we can think of this as, you know, for, I have this slide I talked about memmap pages. We can also think of this as OR read calls, which might be an easier way of thinking about it. But we have both options. We have both, you mmap a file, you access it contiguously, or you call read, and we can record where you read from. So what should my algorithm, what information do I want to keep around? What's something that would be helpful for making these guesses? Yeah? So, okay, so the last K, you know, pages accessed. Pages or things. We might have something other than pages. Okay, that seems useful, yeah.
Could you just track how many contiguous pages of memory you could access?
Okay, so, and you want to see, so our test is based on these last pages, are they contiguous? And if they're contiguous, what do we want to do? Okay. And so our algorithm is we check the last, you know, five things we access. We say, is this things right in the row? And if so, we access the next thing. That seems like a, you know. Next. Get the next. So that seems like a reasonable policy. So there's a bit of trickiness here in that we don't want to mark everything as invalid or like scan all over and over again to get the last five things accessed. So is there a way we can deal with that that's a little better than, you know, scanning a whole file or marking everything as invalid to actually get the last five accesses? But the same idea that we went recently accessed things, we want to know if they're contiguous. How can we do something maybe a bit better? You know, as far as like because the issue I'm talking about is that this policy works great, and it's great for reads, where we can eat, like for free, we can figure out where did you last read the last five times. Like that's basically free. But that's not free for where did you access pages the last five times, because we'd have to mark them as invalid or like scan the reference bits over and over again. So how can we do a little better than that? So note that the idea is we want to confirm our hypothesis of contiguous accesses. How could we do that in a more focused way? So I have my whole file here. And let's say I know that you've accessed right here. What should I be looking for? Yeah? Okay, yeah, we want to look for accesses around it. So we can focus where we check for references. So that's the slight refinement that doesn't require us to track all accesses, is that we track the last few accesses that are around the first access we detected. And this way we can find these change of accesses. And this is basically the sort of policy that Linux uses, is that Linux, when it knows you're reading here, it decides to mark a bunch of pages over here, mark some pages up here as ones it should detect, look for reads on. And when it sees that, it's going to bring in it brings in some extra pages, so it does this read ahead here. So it brings in some extra things, and it figures out a place that it should detect accesses to do the next round of reading ahead, because we want to keep a little bit ahead of you. We don't want to keep too far ahead of you in case you like stop reading. And so their heuristic is that they look for an access after it does that read ahead, like right about here, like before the end, so they have enough time to keep reading and stay ahead of you, but not all the way at the end, so they, you know, or at the beginning, so we're not too far ahead. But it's based on this idea that we see an access and we want to detect accesses a little ahead of it, and then we want to detect accesses, assuming you're keeping scanning, at the end of the region we've already read in order to know when we read more, or if we read more. Yeah?
So does that mean you can only read ahead when there's a page fault, or when a page is invalid?
So the question is, does this mean we can only read ahead if we mark these pages as invalid, or have a page fault, or read to know about it? So you have to have some way of detecting. With this heuristic, you have to have some way of detecting that the read happens. You don't have to mark the pages as invalid. You could like just scan the reference bit. But you have to wait. But in this policy, we're going to wait until we detect that you've actually used some of what you read ahead. And you generally want to do that because you don't want it to be the case that if I like read here, here and here, and then stop reading this file, that you bring in like a gigabyte file for me if I don't have a gigabyte of memory around. So you want to limit the amount of read ahead that happens in order to not have that problem that we mentioned earlier, that if we're too aggressive about this, we'll replace stuff that the program was actually using because we guessed wrong. So Linux is trying to choose a way of guessing which doesn't guess wrong too much. And Linux's heuristics, to be precise, are that to figure out how much to read ahead, they look at the number of cache pages before it, and they decide we're going to read that many more. And as I said, they set this mark where they're going to check to see if you get up to that mark, we're going to read the next chunk. So this is the pages right ahead, and this is where we're going to, this is the start reading when the process gets here. So at some portion of the size they read ahead, which is based on how much is cached, the reason for basing on how much is cached is the idea is that when you have lots of memory free, it's okay to read multiple gigabytes that you might not need. When you don't have lots of memory free, you don't want to do that. And looking at how much is actually cached is sort of a way of taking that into account. Okay. So questions about read ahead? So this is an example of, yeah, sorry.
Why is this faster if you're reading the same amount?
So the question is, why is this faster? So the reason it's faster is that when we're doing the read while the program is processing the data. And our hard drive can read basically for free while we're using the CPU for other things. So we end up actually saving time. It can also write while we're doing other things. So for example, if we're replacing pages that we have to write back to disk to do this, we can do those writes while the program is doing other work too. Yeah, so I guess something that's not obvious about why this saves time is that doing I/O to disk is kind of asynchronous. That we start the I/O, then we wait for an interrupt, and then the I/O finishes. We don't actually need to be working all the time and hogging the CPU all the time. We can have the program use the CPU while the disk is working. Okay, that's a good question. So other questions? So this is an example of proactive strategies. You can imagine other things we might try to do to guess where the program accesses memory and predict it, rather than waiting until the last moment with a page fault to actually act on it. So, talked about sort of the good cases. Now I'm going to talk about the bad case. So there's something called thrashing. So what happens when we just don't have enough memory? Well, when we don't have enough memory, we're hopefully not doing read ahead, because that's going to make it worse. But we're always going to be reading things from disk. And rather than having these reads overlap with computation, we're going to read something from disk, try to switch to something else. That's going to need something else to be read from disk. We're going to try to switch to something else. That's going to need something else to be read from disk. We're going to end up spending all our time, because we just can't keep everything in memory that all our programs need, we're going to spend all of our time reading something from disk or writing things back to disk to make space to read things from disk, and performance gets really, really bad, like intolerably, amazingly bad. And this is especially true these days where, unlike in the, say, the 70s, when people invented and popularized the ideas of virtual memory and page replacement, where disk is really slow relative to memory. So disk like takes milliseconds to do a read, during which you can do, you know, like order a million memory accesses. So it's really bad. This is known as thrashing. And this isn't really something we have a solution for other than run less programs. And I'm mentioning it because this is like a common type of bad behavior you can get on systems when you don't have enough memory. And the way it manifests is not that your program crashes, but that everything on the system is really slow and it's doing lots of disk I/O that doesn't seem to actually accomplish anything, because it's like writing something out only to read it back a little bit later, and spending lots of time doing that. So questions on this? Okay. So I've talked about performance so far. And here I'm talking about performance. Let's say, like with scheduling, maybe our goal isn't performance. We have some other goals. And I mentioned one of them at the beginning, and that was fairness. So let's say, instead of having my goal be that I want to get the best performance for the whole system, whatever that means, that I have multiple users, and I want to treat them fairly, that I want each user to get their fair share of memory, despite the fact I'm queuing caching. And this is actually, you know, it seems intuitively that if I have a gigabyte of memory and four users, each of them gets a quarter of a gig. But that's actually hard to account for in practice. So let's take this example. I have five processes here, and let's say I want each of them to get the same, each of them to share the memory fairly. Are they sharing the memory fairly now? So process A has about 20 megabytes of memory for itself, and it's accessing a shared file that's cached entirely in memory that's 16 megs that process B is also accessing. Process C has 8 meg of memory to itself, but it's accessing a cached file that it's not shared, that only it is accessing. That's 32 megs. And process D and E have a little over 64 megs to themselves, but their entire heap is shared between copy and write. So, for example, how much memory is process D using? Is it using 32 meg? A little, like 34 meg? Because it has, we give it half, count half the heap towards it that's shared? Or is it using 70 meg, or 68 meg? Because it's, but does that mean we double count the stuff that's shared? So this sort of issue where we have shared files, shared copy and write stuff, we have cached files, which maybe we could discard pretty easily, versus the shared heap, make it hard to actually account for sharing memory fairly in practice. And hard to actually give you a number of how much memory is my program using. So, like, for all these programs, you could come up with a bunch of different numbers for how much memory is this program using. And they'd all make sense. And in fact, when you're looking at reports of memory usage, you'll get different versions depending on which one you get. When you look at, like, a process list in your favorite OS, you'll get different different numbers depending on what memory number you look at. So if I want to share fairly, what do you think should my policy be? Which of these processes is getting more than their fair share? If all of them should have the same portion. Yeah. You think C. Why C? Okay, so you think C is getting more because it has 40 meg to itself. Okay. Any other opinions? Yeah.
For DME, since got that right, once one of them writes to the heap, wouldn't DME then have more memory than any other?
Yeah, so we can also make the argument for DME that you know, if the other does something, other writes suddenly, you know, 68 meg. So you could make the argument that because that if D does nothing, it could be the case that it ends up using 68 megs. And so it's using more than its fair share. And that's another reasonable argument about sharing. So this is just a tough choice, and I don't think there's actually consensus on what you should do for accounting memory, but I'm pointing out that it's not as simple as one number because we have all these shared pages and cache pages. And the cache pages make it more complicated because maybe process C doesn't really need all the file to be cached and would do fine if it got evicted from the cache, and maybe it wouldn't. So Linux does have a feature where it tries to allow you to share memory between programs and split up the memory between programs. And it needs to make a choice about how do we count pages, which as you can see is a bit tricky. There's lots of decisions here. So Linux's basic accounting mechanism, they might have some other options, but the sort of default one is based on sort of last touch. Count these shared pages to the last process which used them that the OS noticed and give it to that process. And based on that, you can group processes together into what are called control groups, and you can set memory limits for the groups of processes. And I'll talk about the types of limits in a bit. The idea of these control groups is that you can like take your related applications and say, I want my web server to have this much space, I want the shell that this user is using to have this much space, or you could do this for separate users, and sort of divvy up your machine's memory, but do it in a way which still allows you to take advantage of like file caches and so on. And because we want to do that, we're not going to do something simple like say you have 64 megs of memory exactly. We're not going to like run a VM with that much space. We're going to divide up the memory in a way which tries to allow us to still share space between, say, the web server and my shell if we're accessing the same files. And which also, importantly, that if we have free memory, we don't want to just waste it. We want to use it to cache stuff. So what Linux has chosen to do for this feature is that they have three different limits with all slightly different meanings. So they have this low limit, and the low limit says, if I don't want you to take away stuff from this process if it's above its low, if it's below its low limit, don't take away any of its stuff, even if it's stuff which like it has not touched in forever. Like if it has some file it hasn't accessed for 15 minutes, doesn't matter, it's below its low limit, don't evict it. Because it last touched it, it's memory, it should get to use, get the benefit of having it cached. Because I've given it at least that much memory. We also have a high limit. If the process goes above its high limit, we say, okay, this process has negative priority. I'm gonna steal its pages when I need pages. Because it's above its high limit. But if no one else needs the pages, it's fine. It's gonna get some extra memory. But if I need memory, I'm gonna take it from the process which is above the high limit. And we have a maximum, which is kind of like the strong version of the high limit, where we're gonna say, not only am I gonna take memory if I need it, but I'm gonna take memory even if I don't need it. I'm gonna actively work to evict this process's memory until it gets below its max. And remember that for process's memory, we're counting last touch. So shared pages, if you're the last one to access them, they're yours. Which is imperfect, but is a practical way of implementing policies that still account for that memory in some way. Yeah?
If a process is actively using some of that memory that's above the high limit,
can it still be taken away from it? Like, does that cause some problems? So the question is, if the process is above its high limit and still using the memory, will that be taken away? So when you're taking away memory from a process, you're still gonna try to do least recently used. You're gonna try to take away the process's memory that it's not using the most. So assuming there's some of that, you'll be okay. If there's not, the process will experience thrashing, but only this process will experience thrashing because the other processes will still have enough memory around. So only it will be waiting to like read from disk all the time and write to disk all the time. Which is sort of the idea of this feature, is that if you set the process's limits correctly, at least it's going to run correctly if the system's low on memory. The other processes might not, but it will. Yeah?
So if the process has memory that's above the high limit, does that mean everything between the low and high is being used also?
So the process has memory
above the high limit?
Yes, if the process's memory usage is above the high limit, that means that like if you draw a bar graph, this is the memory it's using. And we're gonna take memory from it, and presumably doing that will eventually get it down to the high limit. Yeah?
What happens to the memory between the low limit and the high limit?
What happens to the memory between the low limit and the high limit? My understanding is it's just allowed to grow the way page replacement would do it naturally. There might be some prioritization between process groups. I'm not actually sure how that works, as far as like what you do if they're all in their range and you need to choose a page to cache. So this is an example of how you can try to do something approximating fair sharing. And with memory, usually our idea of fair sharing is I want to be able to guarantee that, given that I know how much memory the program needs, that it's going to run well. But I still want to give it a little extra memory if we have the space around. And this is kind of a way of achieving that, except that you need to figure out how to set these limits, which, well, it's not going to happen on a desktop, but on a server, this sort of feature is used occasionally. Okay, so let's go on to our next topic, which is I/O. We've talked about paging. I guess move on. Any questions about paging before I move on to talking about I/O, which is like what we're bringing into these pages from files and so on. Yeah.
Is there a way to like make your process faster so you don't have to worry about this? Like,
say when you're running like a Python script or something on the terminal, like you give it some initial parameters and it now doesn't have a high limit or a max, like.
So these limits are not existing by default. By default, just the normal page replacement happens on Linux. This is an optional feature. You can set limits. But the normal behavior is that your memory, if it's not recently used, gets taken away anyways. There are ways of turning that off. Linux and, well, POSIX has a feature called, a function called mlock, which locks memory in memory and keeps it from being evicted ever. For obvious reasons, this requires special privileges because like it really keeps it in memory even if the OS wants more memory. Yeah?
So the control groups are set by like a sysadmin?
Yeah, so this is all set by a sysadmin. And only if the sysadmin sets it, so this feature is usually not used, but mainly because we don't have usually don't have an intelligent way of setting these settings. Okay, so let's move on to I/O. So you remember when we talked about I/O, I said that we had something like a keyboard. The keyboard does a read, the kernel keeps track of that, the input that's waiting to go to the program. Eventually the program makes a system call and it returns that data. Or if we're reading from a file, and we've seen more of this process, assuming we didn't like read ahead or have a cache copy, we're gonna read it from the disk, the kernel's gonna get notified, hey, I have some data for you, and we're gonna send it from that buffer, which we learned was this cache of pages, into the program. And we do something similar for writes. For something like a network device, we have a buffer, where we eventually send it out when the network device tells the processor it's ready. And for a file, we recall we would write to this cache version of the file, and eventually we decide to write that data to disk, hopefully not too late, so we don't lose data if the machine gets unplugged or loses power. Okay, so, and we have these layers. So usually when you use cout printf, there's an additional set of buffering going on before we do the system calls. The system calls go to the kernel's file interface, which has the buffer. And then we have this other component here, which we haven't talked about much, called device drivers. So we have our like file stuff, which deals with like reads and writes and possibly does caching. And then we have our actual device interface, which is the part of the kernel code which knows how like the disk or the network card or the keyboard works and knows how to communicate with that device. So we're going to talk more about a little bit about what these device drivers look like, what the components of them are. First, as a high level note, we've talked about like accessing files, and I've sort of alluded to accessing things like the keyboard directly. So on POSIX, there are two types of ways we commonly access device drivers. So one is that we have files that sit on top of a file system, and the file system has a whole bunch of logic of saying, I have this giant disk, and I'm dividing it up into these little pieces called files. How do I do that? And it's actually handling our reads and writes and forwarding them to the device driver that knows how to talk to the disk, but doesn't understand how to organize data on that disk. We can also talk directly to devices, including disks, with what are known as device files. So these look like files, but instead of communicating with, you know, data on part of a disk and having this caching, they talk directly to the device driver. And this is what we're going to use like to talk to the keyboard and so on. So devices as files, we have an open, read, write, and close interface. And the device driver typically directly has an implementation of this where it decided what's read going to do, what's write going to do, what's mmap going to do. And it might choose for them to do something weird that we wouldn't expect from regular files. And these are everywhere. So let me give an example from a Linux desktop. Here are a bunch of device files that exist on one of my Linux desktops. So we have a device for my audio playback. So, and this is the actual file name. So these are look like normal files, but they don't write to the disk. If you open them, they access the device. So I have an audio file where we can open this, we do some configuration, and then we can just write audio data and it gets played out. So you open, do some stuff, call write, send audio data, and you hear it on whatever's plugged in to the machine. We have devices for the hard drives. So usually we use the file system, but you can open up an mmap or read and write and seek to access the hard drives directly instead of using a file system. We have devices that represent the mouse and keyboard. So the thing which actually handles my keyboard and mouse input when I'm using the machine opens these device files and reads the input from them to figure out where am I moving my mouse, am I clicking it, and so on. And we have devices representing graphics cards. So for example, I have this device file representing the graphics device, which something can open and use some interface to actually draw things on the screen. So these are examples of devices. And you might notice that for some of these, it's pretty straightforward to use our read, write, and so on interface. Like for the hard drive, makes a lot of sense. Read, write, mmap. For a mouse and keyboard, kind of makes sense. We need to figure out what are we reading? What's the format of a mouse click? But we could decide on that, and none of that makes sense. For graphics, it might be a little harder, but for things like graphics and audio, we might want to do some configuration. Like, there's multiple ways we could send audio data, you need to figure out what that is. And that's typically, and for graphics, like, we want to know, like, what's the size of the display, what's the resolution, all that sort of stuff. We need some other ways of telling the device things that don't really work with read and write. We can maybe pigeonhole them in, but they're really awkward. I guess I have other examples. So for the terminal, for example, whether to echo back to the user. For a CD or DVD, you want to like open the disk tray. That's not really a write operation, probably. Or find out, is there a disk in the device at all? So POSIX has this additional thing beyond read and write called IOCTL, and also some special stuff for terminals, because terminals are very important, so they have a whole own special interface in POSIX. But this thing called IOCTL, where the device can add basically extra system calls just for the device that you call in the file. And the device can just have its whole list of operations that you can do for things like, what format of audio do I want to set, and so on. So this is about generally devices. So let's talk about the sort of device driver program. So part of the device driver is that we have these device files. We need to implement read, write, and this IOCTL call, and so on. And the typical way this works, and I'm showing you Linux, is that you just have functions to implement all this. So this is a struct of function pointers. And this is what device drivers do in Linux, is that they just initialize the struct with their functions for everything. So the audio driver has its own version of read, own version of write, own version of IOCTL, own version of mmap that does audio stuff. Note that you might say, how did you do mmap for audio? Well, the device driver could just decide to return an error. You know, it's implementing the system call for this file. It can do whatever it wants. If it doesn't know how to do something well, it can just say, sorry, you can't do that. So this is the typical thing that, as a device driver, this is the top level interface, but we have the other part where we have to get messages from the device. We'll talk about that in a bit. So there's a special case which comes up a lot, which is block devices. So devices like disk are very important and also kind of special. We want to read them and write them in kind of a different way because we want to write them in these big blocks. We know that we want to read them in pages anyways. So typically Unix-like OSs have very special support for this, and those device drivers don't implement the normal file interface, but implement an interface that's in terms of pages, just so they work better with the page cache. And also, the file systems will typically rely on this, and they'll ask to read pages rather than doing reads and writes in byte format. So in Linux, for example, this is what a disk driver implements. It doesn't implement general read and write, it implements this read or write page function. So it doesn't do general read and write, it just has this subset of the interface, which is read or write a page. And then all the page caching stuff we talked about works on top of this. But that doesn't make sense for something like an audio device where you can't like read or write, you know, page 15 of the audio device. That doesn't make any sense. But for a disk, this is the natural interface, and it's so important and so common that they have a special case for it where the disk doesn't have to handle the nits of reading and writing, you know, things within a block. They just give a page at a time. So, questions on these device interfaces? So, I've talked about the interface that we expose to the user. So, let's look at what happens when we use a device driver. So, we open our device file, like our audio device, and we send an IO request. So, it gets a read, a write, or if we're using mmap, it gets like there was a page fault. But it somehow gets this information, hey, the user is trying to read from you or write to you. And the device driver is going to start running. It's going to run one of those functions I showed you in that table. It's going to run like the read-write-page function or the read function or its write function. And the first thing that function is typically going to do is going to say, oh, can I do this already? Is this satisfied for my buffers? So for something like a keyboard, like did I already have the information to say, yep, here's the key I just read? And sometimes the answer is going to be yes, and if the answer is yes, it just returns right away. Say, yep, got that data, here you go. If the answer is no, it's going to actually send the IO operation, and it's going to put whatever thread called it, so whatever called read or write, or whatever thing is has a page fault and is waiting for the data to be available, to sleep. And it's going to have it wait until the IO request finishes. And it's going to send the IO request via some mechanism to the device hardware. And the device, sometime later, is going to trigger an interrupt. And this will enter, you know, an XV6, that trap function. And we'll have a case for that will call our device driver, and we'll update our buffer, so we'll communicate with the device a little bit to figure out, hey, what happened? Did I get my data? Where is it? What's the status of things? And if we need to, we'll wake up the thread we put to sleep. And if we need to, maybe we find out, oh, I only wrote the first 100 bytes, I need to keep writing. Maybe we'll do that, keep writing, and have another interrupt happen. And when we eventually wake up the thread, it's going to read from this buffer and store and return the result and finish, assuming it needed to wait. So questions on this general flow. So there are two parts of the device driver you can see here. I'm going to call this part, which is the part which runs from what you call for read or write, the top half. I'm going to call this part here, which is the trap handler part, the bottom half. So there's two things that as a device driver writer you need to write. You need to write the thing which handles the interrupts and the thing which handles the read and write requests. And they're going to communicate with each other, you're going to keep track of some buffers, but they're separate pieces of code which are run in different contexts. And in particular, the trap handler, it's run in the middle of another process, so it's, you know, very different code to write. And to be concrete, let's look at what this looks like for XV6 and the keyboard. So XV6 has device files, And like Linux, it has a table of function pointers for each device. This is what x86s look like. They don't have IOCTL because they don't care about things like audio devices, where you might need to configure something. So they just have a table of devices, and they just in fact have an array of these tables. And when you open a device file, the file corresponds to an index into this table. And that's what's stored in your open file information in your process struct. It's just a pointer to which of these table entries are we using. Unix actually works similarly. So the device files I showed you have what's called a major and minor number. And that looks up into a table of active devices, which has those read and write operations, similarly to what x86 is doing with one number. And what x86 does is at boot, it sets up the console device, the one that reads from your keyboard, and writes to the screen, and just sets the console read and write functions at a particular index in that table, which is hard-coded. So this is the code which runs when you read or write. This is the top half of the driver. So let's look at what that code looks like. So here's the first part. We check if it's satisfied from the buffers. And if not, we actually queue the operation. And this is, and we're going to look at the read, not the write, because the read is the more interesting part. So the read, we have two pointers to our buffer. We have the place where we're reading from and the place where it's being written. So the beginning and end of the buffer, basically. We say, are they in the same place? If so, we need to keep wait. We need to just wait and go to sleep. And if not, we can actually return our results. So we're going to go to sleep, possibly. And if we don't go to sleep, we're going to return a result. We're going to run the same code regardless after we're done waiting for this to happen. Either we don't wait and it's right away, or we wait and we wake up and do the same operation to read from this buffer we're checking until it has data. And what that looks like is that we take this input buffer at this index R, we add it to the destination, which was just what's being passed to read. And we keep doing that in a loop until we've fulfilled the whole read request, or we found a new line in this case. So either until we've exceeded the size of the buffer, or we've reached a new line, and we return the amount of bytes we read, like the read call is supposed to do. So this code makes sense. So we have our first step, which is check if the buffer has enough data, and while it doesn't, go to sleep. Then take some data from the buffer, add it to what the user passed to read, and keep doing this until we reach a new line or we exceed the size of the user's buffer. So this is the top half. This is the code which runs from user space, and we don't actually interact with the device at all. We just go to sleep waiting for that interrupt handler to wake us up. Okay. Questions? Okay. So that's the top half. So let's talk about the bottom half, the interesting part. So in trap, there's this trap for the keyboard, which has this funny TIRQ0 plus IRQ keyboard is the number of that trap. And this runs this function keyboard interrupt, which is the actually read from the keyboard device function. So this function adds to the buffer and wakes up the process if it needs to. Then we have this other function call, which is called LEAPCIEOI, which tells the CPU, hey, I'm done with this interrupt, you can stop telling me about it. And that's just some bookkeeping which is necessary as part of handling interrupts. Okay. So that's that part. So I'm not going to show the code for this. I'll talk about this at a more high level. But any questions from the high level point of view? Okay, so that's handling drift reading. So let's talk about how devices are actually connected, because how do we communicate with the keyboard? And the way this works is that we have typically our memory bus, which connects to memory, other processors. We've seen that already. But we also have devices on it. And we don't have the keyboard directly. We don't actually plug the keyboard wires indirectly into the memory bus. There's something called a controller. So there's this device controller, which knows how to talk to the memory bus and knows how to talk to our actual hardware, like our keyboard, and does the translation. And our device controller has some buffers and queues, so like it has a buffer of like things that it read that the processor hasn't read back from it yet. And it also has control registers of like, do I have stuff for you? And so on. Or if it's, this is like a sound card, like, you know, what's the format of audio I expect, and so on. And are you sending me data or not? And since this is on the memory bus, what we'll do is we will give addresses to these control registers. That we're on the memory bus, we see a read or write to a memory address, we can say, okay, some of these addresses are mine and I'm going to handle them. That's what the device controller says. So it says, you're trying to write to this address 8004800, this physical address. I'm going to say, okay, that's my status register. I'm going to update my status register with what you're writing. Or if you're reading, I'm going to give you the value of my status register instead of having you get it from a memory. So I'm going to implement the same protocol that memory implements, but I'm going to do it instead of you. It's going to look like memory. So you just write and write to memory, and you actually get at my status registers, and so on. And you can use these to actually access them. So if there's a keyboard, you can leave the status register and say, do you have keys waiting for me? Or if it's like a terminal, like an output device, like a modem, you can say, can I write output to you? Also, these control registers might not really be registers, or might do something special. So for example, we might have a control register that's write, where if you write to it, what it actually does is it sends the buffer to like the output. Like if we have a network card, you might poke at this write address, you just write to that memory, and it doesn't actually change the register, it just says, okay, now I'm gonna write the buffer you wrote earlier into my network output. And the device controller can do this because it sees all the writes. It doesn't actually need to write to values in its memory or registers. It can just do some action based on what it saw on the bus. And it will commonly use these registers in that way. So reading or writing from the register might actually do some operation that the device controller has chosen to do. So in this way, you can use reads and writes to memory locations to actually access things, to actually change what happens, to send audio out or to send some data out on the network and so on. These device controllers will often have buffers or queues, and these can also have memory addresses in the same way. So they might have a little, like your network card might have a little buffer on it of the data you want to send out next. So the way you access it might be, you first write to the buffer at some memory addresses, and then you poke at this special write register, and that causes the data in the buffer to go out to the wire. And of course, the exact way this works is up to the device and varies a lot between devices. There's not like one standard. You have to like read the documentation for the device on how did I choose to set up my control registers, which of them are kind of very magical, which aren't, and so on. Okay, so questions so far? So this is our memory map device interface. So the other thing we have is we have this interrupt controller here, and we have some separate way for devices to trigger interrupts. So there's some line to the processor besides the memory bus, typically, or maybe it's part of the memory bus, but some way for devices to trigger an interrupt when they know the processor needs to know something. And that's how the interrupts happen. But that's independent from actually reading and writing from the device. Okay. So I've shown you this sort of idea that the devices are directly on the memory bus. That's not typically the case. So often there's what's known as a bus adapter, and we'll have some other interface. Probably the most common one you've seen is USB. So we'll have some USB adapter that will do another layer of translation because we don't actually have our devices directly support the memory bus. So USB is an example, PCI is another example. We have these adapters to interface between one and another, but the idea is the same, and the adapter sort of acts as a proxy, forwarding messages to the actual device controllers and back. And it looks to the processor like it's connected directly, usually. Okay, so questions? So in this sense, we can think of devices as magic memory. So for example, our keyboard controller, a common way it might work is you read from a particular place, you get the last key press. And maybe reading from that place, because this is the device controller knows you did that, it clears it and waits, you get the next key press later on. Like that acknowledges that you did that and lets you get more. And you get an interrupt as long as there's a key press you haven't read. That might be the way the device works. And a display controller, maybe you write pixels to a magic memory location, you write just the value, the colors you want on the screen to a magic memory location, and it just gets displayed on the screen. And the way that works is that memory location is actually in the device controller, and it copies that to the screen like every 60th of a second or something like that. And maybe there's some other memory locations which are actually control registers there which say what's the size of the screen, and it looks at that every 60th of a second and tries to reconfigure what it's sending to the monitor based on it. Or with a network interface, we talked about you write to some buffer somewhere and you have a send now signal which actually sends the data, and you have some status interface to learn like was it sent, do you have more data for me, and so on. Okay. So that's the magic memory. So there's one little issue with this interface, and that's caching. So let's say I have my keyboard controller, I read from a memory location, I get the last key press. Let's say I have caching. So I read, I press H, the OS reads H, let's say I cache that, what's gonna happen? Yeah. Will my cache what? This is the question, are you worried that my cache will fill up? So no, because there's only one memory location which has all the key presses. Yeah.
Aren't you just gonna keep pressing H because you don't see it?
Yeah, so we're only gonna see the H if we keep it cached, right? We've cached an H, and why would we remove that from our cache? So something needs to keep that from being cached. And you could think maybe the device controller should do like we did for threading and invalidate that cache block. This is not the choice which is made by almost all devices. Instead, the processor, the OS, is going to need to do something smart. And the typical solution is that the OS can mark memory as uncacheable. In x86, there's a bit in the page table entry which says, hey, when you're using this page table entry, don't cache anything. And that's what you'll use to access these devices. Okay, so next time we'll finish up talking about some other nits of devices and hopefully get on to file systems. And if we don't actually get to FAT next time, I will delay the FAT deadline a little bit.